Hi, everybody. Welcome to Neuroscientist Talk Shop, UTSA's Neuroscience Research Podcast. Today is September 26th, 2024. We're talking to Jones Parker. Jones is assistant professor in the departments of neuroscience, pharmacology, psychiatry, and behavioral sciences at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Jones's lab is studying the mechanism of action of antipsychotic drugs in the brain, as well as some other things, but we're going to talk about that today. And this is a topic that's attracted a huge amount of attention over many years, and there's a very large literature on it. But the literature we've inherited from that work is full of mysteries and contradictions. And one problem, at least as I see it, is that attention was paid to the pharmacology of the drugs that can be used to treat psychosis as a what receptor do they bind to kind of problem, and then efficacy. So it's like receptor and efficacy. And somewhere in there, there's a big complicated thing. There's the brain. It's full of neurons and action potentials and different parts of the brain working. And that was mostly skipped over. And maybe just out of necessity, because some things are hard. And then there was a kind of story built, a kind of mythology built to explain the missing information between receptor and human experience. And the cool thing about what you're doing is you're going in and checking that mythology. You're testing it. You are examining it more closely, I think, than normal. And you have some very cool methods that allow you to look at what the neurons are doing in a better way than anybody could ever have done in the past. So, and you've seen some unexpected things. So, welcome, Jones Parker.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Charlie.
And also with us is Matt Wonnett, our local dopamine and brain neurons expert. Hi, Matt.
Howdy.
And me, I'm Charlie Wilson. So, Jones, I don't know if you agree with what I just said or not, and we could start by just asking you to give your own summary from your own perspective of what we know about antipsychotic drugs mechanism of action, what we knew when you started,
right,
and then sort of what you're filling in.
Yeah, I think you did a good job of summarizing what the sort of state of understanding of what these drugs do is at the time we initiated this study, and that's really focused on the molecular mechanism of action of drugs. And this is very satisfying to know with exquisite detail exactly what receptors each antipsychotic drug binds to and mapping that onto the different efficacy and side effect profiles of the drugs. And so you'll often see these charts of receptor binding profiles of atypical and typical antipsychotics, and it's thought that interaction with D2 confers antipsychotic effect. Perhaps interaction with histamine receptors or serotonergics confers risk for metabolic disorder. And of course, interaction with the 5-HT2 receptors confers atypicality, right? And so so that is a very satisfying understanding, but it doesn't actually tell us, as you pointed out, how the drugs are actually working within the brain. We know their molecular mechanism of action, and we use that to infer their efficacy and side effect profiles, but what is their circuit level mechanism of action? How are they actually interacting with the areas of the brain that are thought to underlie psychosis? And that's sort of what we set out to study. And we took clues from clinical effects. So we know some drugs work better than others. We know that in general, they tend to interact with the D2 dopamine receptor. At the talk today, we presented this work from, I think, Phil Seaman and Solomon Snyder's lab showing this interaction. This is a plot everyone thinks about when they think about how antipsychotic drugs work, is this linear relationship between potency and D2 receptor occupancy, really cemented an association between D2 and antipsychosis. But aside from knowing that, how that actually translates to antipsychotic effect in the brain, it was really unknown to us.
And even the association with basal ganglia, it's just because that's where there's a lot of D2 receptors.
That's right.
Which really is all
yeah.
there is.
And well, there were studies from Nissa Abidargam's lab in New York. Sorry, I don't remember her university, but where they did PET imaging studies and observed these increases in dopamine. But the only reason they ended up looking there, right, is because of the D2 association to begin with, right? Yeah.
So how do we go farther? Where's the foothold on the next step in breaking open this problem?
Yeah, so we reasoned that if we, so first of all, I was sort of trained to use the in vivo imaging tools that we talked about today, miniature microscopes, two-photon imaging, to advance neuroscience drug discovery, first in the context of Parkinson's disease. And when I started my own lab, I wanted to shift that focus to psychiatry, partly because we have many more drugs to explore. We have a wider range of therapies for diseases like schizophrenia, with varying side effect profiles, varying levels of efficacy, a lot of different molecular mechanisms of action, right? There's a lot of heterogeneity between these drugs, which are some of which are very dirty. But what we wanted to see is what do the drugs have in common with one another, and how is that shared between drugs that do work in patients versus drugs that did not work? And so to do this, we sort of looked at their effects on D1 and D2 spiny projection neuron activity, direct and indirect pathway spiny projection neurons, and asked the simple hypothesis of whether these drugs were preferentially acting on D2 receptor expressing spiny projection neurons, as many of us assumed that they did, right? And then so to our surprise, what we found was that drugs that were working in patients, even if they're really highly selective for D2 dopamine receptors, are actually affecting the activity of these D1 spiny projection neurons. And that led us to start thinking of, could we develop more sort of targeted therapies to going after those neurons specifically that may work for more patients and have fewer of the adverse effects, as opposed to these D2 binding drugs, which are likely to be indirectly modulating that cell population.
So from the Parkinson's disease literature, which I know you know because you're from that world, mm-hmm. D1 and D2 spiny projection neurons have their own set of implications. The D1 neurons are supposed to be behavioral promoting neurons and D2 behavioral inhibiting mm-hmm. neurons. So how does psychosis fit into that? If psychosis was too much dopamine, what would that make you do? Make you inhibited and activated both at the same time?
Or? Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think a part of the difference between I think part of the difference is how the basal ganglia have been repurposed through evolution by the human brain, right? So too much dopamine in an animal looks like an animal running more, right? It's very important for animals to move towards and away from things in their environment. They were really geared to do that. Whereas over the course of evolution, I think that our brains have learned to use the basal ganglia differently, right? For different purposes. And in some cases, excess dopamine may not look like me running around this room as it does in a mouse, but it may reflect overactive thought processes or something like that in the brain, because my cortex has tapped in and utilized the basal ganglia in a different way than a mouse's brain has.
Well, so to follow up on that, how can we actually look at psychosis, or what sort of models can we use in rodents to sort of at least mirror the process that we think is what's happening in humans?
Yeah, so we've sort of taken a rather reductionist approach to studying the role of dopaminergic transmission, because of course that has been associated with psychosis, and it's certainly in line with the antipsychotic drugs we're interested in studying. And so I don't think like a rodent can't really have schizophrenia per se, right? Because their brains are very, very much different from the human brain.
Or if they did, you would have no way of knowing it.
Yes, yes. And so we basically just break down the disease into sort of component parts that we can study in the rodent. And in this case, we can study excess dopaminergia by manipulating dopamine transmission to the sort of rodent equivalent areas of the human brain.
So that leaves us kind of wondering about the relationship between psychosis and the stuff we study, doesn't it? I mean, don't you have some behavioral tests beyond just running around in a box?
Yeah, so in our lab, we study, so that within the disease of schizophrenia, which is sort of a spectrum disease, it manifests differently in different patients. There are classes of symptoms that are classically termed the positive, negative, and cognitive symptoms, right? So the positive symptoms tend to be the ones that we think about when we think about schizophrenia, which is hallucinations and delusions, largely auditory hallucinations and delusional thought. The negative symptoms are things that are lost in the disease. So positive symptoms are things that are gained. The negative are things that are lost. And so such as the loss of speech, the loss of the ability to experience pleasure, these sorts of depressive-like symptoms. And then in the third bucket, we have the cognitive symptoms, which are deficits in executive function and things we can study easily in rodents using tasks such as working memory. So our lab uses behavioral assays of all three. Classically, open field locomotion has been considered a positive-like symptom for the reasons I think we just talked about. The rodent striatum is really tuned to move. And even though movement in and of itself is not a positive symptom, it is how excess dopaminergia is manifest in the rodent. And this behavioral response is responsive to antipsychotic drugs. And so that's one of the reasons people use locomotor activation as a readout of antipsychotic drug potential. So we of course look at open field, what I like to call the simplest dopamine dependent behavior of all time from my experience working with dopamine deficient mice in Richard's lab and seeing them stiff as a board until they got their daily L-DOPA injection. But of course we've over time adopted other assays, behavioral assays, and one we presented to today was work from Katarina Schmock when she was in Adam Kepik's lab at Washington University, which is this hallucination-like auditory perception task. And so this is a signal detection task where the animal reports having heard a tone or having not heard a tone by choosing a left or a right port. And it turns out if you drive dopamine transmission, you can cause the animal to self-report having heard the tone more often when it was not played. So they have more of these false alarms. And then, as I mentioned today in the talk, one of the genius behind the assay is they incorporated this investment time component. So after the animal made a choice, you delay when the reward is delivered, and you can measure the amount of time the animal spends waiting for the reward as an indicator of their confidence in their decision. And so what we found in our study and what Katarina showed is if you drive dopamine release, you can cause the animals to have more of these false alarms, to self-report having heard a stimulus when none was played. But you can also increase the amount of time they're willing to invest. And both of these, the rate of false alarms and the investment time, are reduced by pre-treating the animals with antipsychotic drugs. So that's a pretty good state-of-the-art positive symptom assay. We talked about a couple more this morning that people use. Sensory motor gating was very popular early 2000s and the 90s. Also an antipsychotic responsive behavior, also disrupted by, this is typically measured in rodents, by prepulse inhibition. And amphetamine treatment or PCP treatment disrupts sensory motor gating and antipsychotic drugs reverse that. So people focused on that circuitry for a long time. Another one is latent inhibition, where you pair a tone with a shock, or you pair a tone, you pre-expose an animal to a tone. And then if you give them a drug like amphetamine, they'll overvalue that stimulus. And then it will later on, they're unable to ignore it in later on training. So that's another one. That one's a little trickier for us because it's one trial, one shot learning. Most of the stuff we're interested in is usually tasks that are performance based. So those are the positive symptom assays, latent inhibition, sensory motor gating, open field, hallucination-like perception. Those are the sort of things in that bucket that we can study. In terms of negative symptoms, one can look at one of the things that we use, which is sort of quick and dirty in the lab, is a juvenile social exploration assay. So mice are naturally inclined to interact with juvenile animals, usually with conspecifics, so male mice with male juveniles, female with female juveniles. And so they'll naturally explore the animal and you can quantify their approach to the animal, sniffing, genital sniffing, different categories of social exploration. One could do other social assays like social CPP. So that was one that we used in our neuropsychopharmacology paper in 2023 to assess a sort of negative symptom-like behavioral profile. And then for cognition, our go-to assay in the lab is delayed non-match-to-sample spatial working memory. So this is done in a T-maze where the animal must traverse the maze and gets a forced trial to go in one direction and come back. And then on the subsequent trial, they have to choose the opposite arm to get the reward. And this is very commonly used to measure working memory. So we have sort of three categories of symptoms. And these are just examples of behaviors that can kind of fall into these different categories or reflect behavioral processes that are disrupted in these three different categories.
So that's a lot. Actually, it's a lot of opportunities to ask yourself, what do antipsychotic drugs do to the neurons while this is going on.
That's right. So we initially spread ourselves pretty thin in the work that was discussed today, right? We looked at open field and tested a lot of different drugs. But where we're going is imaging neural activity during some of these tasks, and perhaps as a way to distinguish between drugs that may, for example, address cognitive deficits in addition to positive symptoms. And that's something, that's a direction that the lab is currently going.
So, I mean, that opens up sort of the million-dollar question here is, you've got these positive symptoms that are typically associated by excessive dopamine, but then you have these, you know, cognitive deficits that often are characterized by maybe, you know, lower levels of dopamine in other pathways. How can we get the silver bullet? Or is there some strategy that we could be able to find a pharmacological agent that might be able to normalize these deficits in, you know, excessive and low levels of dopamine in sort of different circuits? Is there sort of any hope, or are we only going to be treating one set of symptoms or another set of symptoms if we're thinking about trying to maybe manipulate the dopamine pathway in sort of the treatment for schizophrenia?
First off, manipulating the dopamine pathway, right? I mean, the first question in that is, so what happens? Yeah. If I give an antipsychotic drug, I would guess I would see some change in the neurons. I have D2 receptors, mm-hmm. and nothing in the others, or something smaller in the others, or something indirect mm-hmm. in the rest of the neurons.
Right.
That has got to be what you thought you were going to see when you first did this.
Yeah, so we expected when we started out that it would preferentially be acting on these D2, these neurons with enriched in the principal target of the drugs. But they're also going to interact with other neurons in this, not only in the striatal subcircuit, but in the cortex and in the midbrain that express D2 receptors. And this includes dopamine neurons themselves, cholinergic interneurons, neurons that innervate the structure, of course. So D2 receptors are not only in the striatum, and the drugs are administered systemically. We talked a little bit about this today, how these complex effects could be reflecting processes of the drugs that are in areas upstream of the striatum. Just to go back a little bit to Matt's question, I think, you know, first and foremost, with an antipsychotic drug that you're developing, is you want it to treat the positive symptoms, right? It needs to work for those, first of all. First and foremost, those are, I think, by far the most debilitating for everyday life for these patients. And so I think what you want is a drug that's affecting, it has a neural signature of clinical efficacy, such as the one we characterized in our paper, which is sort of the ability to suppress D1 hyperactivity, specifically under hyperdopaminergic conditions.
So really, I'd like to hear more about that, because we're skipping over the finding, which was that the D2 neurons are not mm-hmm. the ones that are primarily affected by the
yeah.
drugs that affect D2 receptors.
Yes, yeah. So I think that what sealed the deal on that for me was in the initial set of studies where we compared haloperidol to clozapine, which is, of course, as we talked about, is sort of the most effective antipsychotic drug of all time, largely because it's more effective in patients with treatment-resistant schizophrenia. But overall, the numbers, if you look at the meta-analysis, clozapine stands apart from the other drugs. And we compared that to this drug, MP10. So I knew a lot about this drug because it was being developed when I was at Pfizer, and I knew that it failed in clinical trials, despite looking good in these basic preclinical assays. So what sealed the deal for me was when we started looking at the D2 activity, we saw that Haldol increased D2-SPN activity. So amphetamine suppressed it, and Haldol reversed that. But then we looked at clozapine, and it had no effect on D2-SPN activity at all. And then this drug, MP10, which didn't work in patients, totally normalized D2-SPN activity. So here you have two drugs that work. One normalizes it, one doesn't. The one that doesn't happens to work very well. And then a drug that doesn't work at all that totally normalizes it, right? So we were like, what is going on here? And it was really exciting to see these data come in. So when Song-Sik looked, the postdoctoral fellow in my lab, Song-Sik looked at what the drugs were doing to D1 SPNs, there you saw segregation between drugs that worked and didn't work. So clozapine and Haldol both suppressed D1 SPN hyperactivity. So amphetamine treatment drove the activation of D1 spiny projection neurons. But this drug, MP10, that didn't work in patients actually exacerbated that hyperactivity. And the story really clicked right there. And that's what motivated us to look at some of these other drugs. And I think that gets back to sort of what you were thinking of how do you sort of normalize dopamine across structures, right? That became the next question. So we know what we need to do in striatum, but then how can we improve some of the dopamine abnormalities elsewhere in the brain, such as cortical areas? And that's, I think, one of the promises of drugs like xanomeline. So KarXT, I think, is in phase 3 clinical trials, probably inevitably will be approved for as the first non-dopaminergic drug for psychosis. But there, you're engaging cholinergic mechanisms. And of course, we talked about this today. Those are likely engaging spiny projection neurons as well, because they do express, D2 expresses M1 receptors, and D1 SPNs express both M1 and M4. But these drugs may also engage cholinergic receptors like M1 in the cortex, which could potentially also address cognitive symptoms. And I think that preliminary evidence suggests from their clinical studies that it may actually have some cognitive benefit. I think the jury is still out. But these drugs may address abnormalities across different brain structures, including not only in the striatum, which may ameliorate cognitive deficits. And this is also why we got very excited about this D1 partial agonism idea, which is currently, we're still currently exploring.
So, so I guess I'm still not exactly clear on the story about the spiny projection neurons that have D1 and D2 receptors, because it sounds like the antipsychotic drugs work on both of them, even though only one of them has D2 receptors. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that really separates them is the relationship between the change in neural activity and the efficacy of the drug in, as an antipsychotic drug. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's an argument. That's the way the argument has always been posed, mm-hmm. actually. It's what receptor is best predictive of mm-hmm. clinical efficacy. And so now we're moving the argument to what activity in what neuron is best predictive of clinical efficacy in the striatum.
Right.
And it looks like the answer is D1 neurons, the neuron that has the D1 receptor rather than the neuron that has the D2 receptor, is best predictive, although both of them are affected. Mm-hmm. And presumably, you know, if we looked at all the other cells in the striatum or cells in the cortex and the thalamus and mm-hmm. as well, we would see changes mm-hmm. in all of them. And then the question would be, which of those changes is most predictive of efficacy?
Yeah.
I think that's a great, from a drug designer's point of view, that's a great angle to take, because now you can move the argument from what receptor am I looking at to what neuron's activity is best predicted. Mm-hmm. And then I could design a drug that makes the neurons do it.
That that would be a circular thing. I think that there's sort of two schools of thought on drug development. Not, there's many schools of thought on drug development, but there's targeted drug development. And I think that there was a big boon in that over the last, you know, with the information boom where we know all this information about specific targets. But then there's more of like a phenotypic screen, right? So does this normalize the animal's behavior? I don't care mechanistically how it works, but is the endpoint, you know, is the behavioral endpoint normalized? This drug works because it works, right? And I think that this in vivo imaging is somewhere in between, right? So it is like a phenotypic readout, but the readout is mechanistic, neural circuit mechanistic, right? So it's not as targeted, not as like drug target development, so targeted drug development, but instead it's sort of understanding what the drug is doing to brain activity as the readout. So it's almost like a phenotypic screen, but based on circuit mechanisms.
So, but it does sort of focus in on particular circuit.
Right.
So this problem, which is my drug could be working in any part of the brain and or in many parts of the brain, and I don't know which ones are responsible for that good mm-hmm. Results of the drug versus the bad.
Yeah.
Or I could say, well, at least I know that what I'm looking at is this one part of the brain, and I could try to tune things to do what I think that part of the brain is supposed to be doing. Is that moving us in the direction of being more targeted?
I don't know. I mean, I guess my thinking here is that just going back to mice don't have schizophrenia, right? What I know is that these drugs work in patients, and this is what they're doing to neural activity. So the mice don't have that disease. The mice brain architecture is different than the humans, right? Antipsychotic drugs don't typically work the first time you take them, right? We're looking at just one-shot effects, right? This dopaminergic manipulation we have is transient, right? So there are many things that are different between these animals and what's going on in the brains of patients with schizophrenia. But what I do know is that the drugs that work in that context do this in this context. So this could be a mouse's brain doing in vivo imaging. It could be looking at dendritic spines and cell culture or something like that, right? So we know that we're reverse translating from what works in patients to get a handhold on something we can study and manipulate in an animal that is not directly related, but indirectly related. So I don't know. So probably what we're observing is not antipsychotic drug action as it occurs in the patients, where they have to be on it for a week, 10 days before it starts working, right? But we have a sort of an acute drug effect that may need to happen the first time and happen over and over and over again in order to lead to antipsychotic effect down the road.
Well, that opens up the question. Have you played around and looked at how repeated injections affects then the cellular activity? And I guess it opens up also another question of when should we be, what is the critical time that we should be looking at the cellular activity? Should we be looking at a baseline state, or should we be looking when the animal might be in sort of a hyperactive dopamine state, or should we be looking at both? Yeah, I guess there's a whole range of questions to sort of tease apart to really get at this phenotypic screen. And I guess how far have you dug down into this as far as repeated injection, when we should be looking at cellular activity and so forth?
Yeah, so these are great questions. I mean, we've, as I mentioned before, we kind of started broad, right? We wanted to test a lot of different compounds. And so in that case, we were limited to doing acute effects, right? But it would be excellent to look at more longitudinal effects. We're in the process of developing better models than this sort of amphetamine model, which we chose because we knew it wasn't good, right? Because we knew it had failure modes. I wouldn't say we knew it wasn't good, but we knew it had failure modes when used as a behavioral readout. And so, I think it would be excellent to do more longitudinal hyperdopaminergia, see how the neural circuit function is changing in that model. Untreated schizophrenia is a pretty bad thing too, right? So the longer a patient goes, the more psychotic episodes they have, the worse their prognosis becomes. So that would be something interesting to look at. Another, we could do chronic administration of haloperidol, so multi-day. We've never looked at that. That would be a good starting point. Some people also use these sort of implantable pellets animals will eventually develop tardive dyskinesia. And of course, from my work as a postdoc, we know what the neural signature and stridum of L-DOPA induced dyskinesia is. And I'm curious as to whether that looks similar in drug-induced dyskinesia, where animals develop these vacuous chewing movements after months of haloperidol treatment. There's just many other different scenarios in which to explore this to better understand perhaps what's going on in the human.
So just being able to answer the question of what happens in the brain when an animal is given an antipsychotic drug seems to me like a worthy thing. Like the story has always had a big gap there. Mm-hmm. And knowing anything about what's going on in the brain is an advancement. But the way you're saying it sounds like it's not, you're not satisfied with the advancement that you get just by doing that. Like, my first thought would be, I'll just give haloperidol to a mouse and see what the neurons do. Everybody thinks that when you do that, the D2 neurons are going to be affected more than the D1 neurons. Mm-hmm. I'll just check if that's true. And it turns out not to be so accurate. Like, is that not a huge leap forward?
It is a good jumping off point, but I think, we tested a rich array of drugs, including the cholinergic ones and typicals versus atypicals. And they did have this effect in common that they were normalizing, hyperactivity in D1 spiny projection neurons. But I think what we're interested in now is, those drugs are very different from one another. We know their molecular mechanisms of action, if you look at the heat map of their binding affinities, are quite different from each other. So they can't all be having this effect in the same way. So my prediction is that, a drug like haloperidol, which is relatively selective for D2 D2 receptor or a drug like amisulpiride, which is highly selective for D2 receptors. We've seen that drug also suppresses D1-SPN hyperactivity. Are those drugs that, for instance, acting through cholinergic interneurons for is one possibility, right? So they could be increasing acetylcholine levels, which through the cholinergic mechanism of action is suppressing D1-SPN hyperactivity. Is that the same way in which clozapine is suppressing D1-SPN activity? I don't know. Probably not, because clozapine did not elevate D2-SPN activity, so I don't think it's necessarily engaging D2s in the same way that haloperidol is. But maybe it is acting as a partial agonist itself at the D1 receptor. So they may have different molecular mechanisms of action that actually end up with the same result, which is, you know, predictive of efficacy. And this is something that we're trying to tease apart mechanistically using combinatorial in vivo imaging approaches, like I presented a little bit today, doing simultaneous acetylcholine and SPN calcium.
It seems if you could find that final common path of whatever thing has to be changed, no matter how you get there, mm-hmm. that would be the goal. Would be to see that.
Yeah.
Because, of course, there's a long chain of causation that goes from dopamine receptor to behavior. Mm-hmm. And there are many different parts of the brain that are probably involved. And you could start studying one of them, could turn out to be kind of just a wild goose chase. This one changes a lot, but doesn't have anything to do with the thing I'm interested in. Or there could be 10 different ways of getting neuron A to fire more. Mm-hmm. Whenever neuron A fires more, then I get psychosis or something like that.
Yeah.
So is the brain just such a large causal web that it's impossible to find your way through that and to find the key component of it? Or after working on this for a while, do you think, oh no, we've got the tools to do that, to sort out causation in there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a tricky problem, and especially with the systemic administration of the drugs. But again, I think that's very important for us. This is sort of a niche for us, is using these tools to do in vivo pharmacology. Not a lot of labs are using the tools as explicitly for these purposes as we are. Uh-huh. And so we think it's pretty important to give them systemically, but it would be interesting, as we kind of discussed today at the talk, is to do more local administrations to understand mechanism of action in that manner.
Would you be willing to say that, like, this is the final common pathway? Or so, like, all of these drugs, I mean, we don't know. There's a huge black box. And yeah, it's challenging, you know. Yes, maybe one drug is, you know, playing a role on dopamine receptors in brain region A, and another drug's having a role on dopamine receptors in brain region B. But in some ways, that doesn't matter, because really the final pathway is, okay, what's happening on, you know, the D1 neurons that you're seeing in the striatum? And is that, because that's really, to me, the only way that I can wrap my head around these things. We're giving drugs that are preferentially affecting D2 receptors, and it's having this paradoxical effect. And in some ways, it's almost screaming that it's not actually the local. Maybe there are some that are affecting locally, but I would say the more likely scenario is it's actually outside of the striatum, and this is the net, you know, output pathway. And I guess, am I thinking about that wrong? Or is it maybe all striatal, and maybe
Yeah, that I don't know. I think we'd have to do a local type of experiment. I mean, the closest we got to sort of addressing whether that is a sort of final common pathway were the chemogenetic experiments that Sangsik did, where he expressed the GI dread in dorsomedial striatum D1-SPNs, which is where we did all of our imaging experiments, and showed that, again, just to go back to our buckets of behavioral assays, that normalized amphetamine-driven hyperlocomotion, and it normalized the misperception in this auditory perception task. Now, we haven't tested that in other behavioral assays related to, like, cognition or something like social exploration, but we're headed in that direction, yeah.
Okay, well, it seems like there's still a lot to do.
There sure is.
So thanks for explaining it to us. Jones Parker, thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me.
And Matt.
As always.
And this has been Neuroscientist Talk Shop.